Well, we've had a full morning, have we not? So full, some of you are just saying, well, let's go home now. Well, stay with me. Can you do that? We're going to have a message together, and I'm looking forward to this because we get to preach from the book of Philippians. And so just a couple, three verses from Philippians 3, 12 through 14. Some of you might have even memorized this passage because it's such a common one. Philippians 3, 12 through 14. Now, you know that a couple weeks ago I was working on my cool factor and I wore the toque. Remember, and I really improved my cool factor. Well, Ivan wanted me to take it another step further, so check this out. Whoa. I'm thinking after sabbatical, when I come back, I'm going to have a ponytail. Maybe that'll help. I'll wear a toque ponytail and sharp socks, and we'll see how it goes. And this is the way this passage starts out. Not that I've already obtained all of this. Not that I've already obtained all of this. Or have already arrived at my goal, but I press on to take hold of that for which Christ Jesus took hold of me. Brothers and sisters, I do not consider myself yet to have taken hold of it, but one thing I do, forgetting what is behind and straining toward what is ahead, I press on toward the goal to win the prize for which God has called me heavenward in Jesus Christ. What a fabulous passage of Scripture. Have you noticed that we live in unique times? These are times that really there's not much parallel for them in history in some ways. Because knowledge has become the great power in the world. It used to be that guns and tanks were the great power. Now knowledge has become the great power. But what has happened that's unique in our time is the marriage between knowledge and technology. It's the marriage between knowledge and technology. In times past, say, the technology of, say, a hoe or an axe could be created, right? It made a difference. A hoe or axe helped you farm. And you were more effective because of the hoe or the axe. But it did not particularly advance the field of knowledge. The invention of the hoe or the axe. Now, our technology is designed to feed and extend the world of knowledge at an unbelievable rate. Until 300 years ago, it was possible for a human being to basically master the field of human knowledge. Isn't that something? One person could do that. People like Socrates in his time, just a few couple hundred years before Christ, they said he was able to master the field of human knowledge. Leonardo da Vinci, 1500s, he mastered the field of human knowledge. Many believe that the last person to ever be able to do that was Gottlieb Leibniz, who was a mathematician philosopher about 300 years ago. The kind of thinking they were doing began to open, Leibniz and others, open the door for rationalism. The belief that the advancement of human knowledge and therefore human reason can find rational solutions to all of human problems. That's where that began with Leibniz and some of those back there. Immanuel Kant. Buckminster Fuller created the knowledge doubling curve. He noticed that until 1900, human knowledge doubled approximately every century. By the end of the Second World War, knowledge was now doubling every 25 years. On the average today, now human knowledge is doubling at the rate of every 13 months. See how fast that's going? According to IBM, the build-out of the Internet of Things will lead to the doubling of knowledge every 12 hours. In turn, this exponential growth of knowledge will require massive technological advances, the like of which we've not seen yet. One of those prognosticators, David Russell Schilling, explains, dealing with this information will necessitate the development of vastly more complex software, shareability, and artificial intelligence. Glenn Beck suggests that in order to survive such an onslaught, you must hold fast to your convictions and truly understand what you believe. I like that. It's going to require that you hold fast to your convictions and truly understand what you believe. Well, that's what you and I are about. Just a couple of years ago, I was sitting in a class at Fuller Seminary where I was taking a course from the professor who used to be the dean of the School of Psychology. He's now in his 80s. And he said that our use of technology is now rewiring the brain for speed, believe that, but not for content. Rewiring the brain for speed, but not for content. Even young people who are sitting in the sanctuary here this morning, 10 years old and up, you're aware of the accelerated rate of knowledge and of life more than I ever was at your age. Within the span of 1 year, knowledge doubles. It is now well beyond the human capacity to ever master all of human knowledge. We live in a time now where specialization is increasingly narrowing, where people become experts in a very tiny piece of knowledge because that's all that they can handle. And of course, I believe that that very soon will pass as well. No wonder our brains are rewiring for speed instead of content. No wonder our relationships are shattering in the light of that. No wonder our pursuit of God seems to be mostly about speed and not content. We now have to leave most of the content to the internet and try to find ways of just processing what little bit we can. We're becoming experts in the use of our technology rather than the masters of knowledge. What this is actually doing is widening the gap between knowledge and knowing. Do you hear that? It's widening the gap between knowledge and knowing. We seem to have accumulated a vast amount of knowledge, but we know very little. It's what Paul is driving at in this passage. In just a couple of verses prior to what we've read this morning, in 3:10, he says, I want to know Christ and the power of his resurrection. He doesn't say, I'm trying to increase my knowledge about Christ, as much as he's saying, I want to know Christ. Of course, we need knowledge. It's absolutely essential. How can you know a person if you don't know anything about them? When I first met Lori, I wanted to know all about her. I wanted to know where she was from. I wanted to know what her background was. I wanted to know where she went to school. I wanted to know what her family was like. I wanted to know who her friends were. I know what she wanted to do or where she wanted to go. All those things, as I gathered that information, provided a foundation for me upon which I could then get to know her. You see, I wasn't writing a report on Lori. I wasn't investigating her so that I could deliver a report to college and say, this is who Lori is. I wanted to have a relationship with her. Scholars over the centuries have helped us to understand who Jesus was. Knowledge is at an all-time high about Jesus. Theology continues to explode as a field of study. It teaches us who Jesus is, and it teaches us to understand what he taught. What did he mean when he told that parable? What did he mean when he wrote the Sermon on the Mount? What does he mean when he talks to us in the way that he does? Thousands and thousands of books filled libraries. I've been in some of the big theological libraries, and it's overwhelming, all this about this man Jesus. But what's interesting in our passage here is Paul isn't describing an insatiable need or curiosity about Jesus. He isn't saying, I want to know more about, I'm doing a research project about, I'm so fascinated or intrigued by, I'm trying to solve a mystery of. No. I want to know Christ. In fact, Paul adds a little bit to what I've quoted here so far about the message. He said, I want to know Christ and the power of his resurrection. And what else? And the fellowship of his suffering, becoming like him in his death. Okay, this is far more than somebody doing a research project or writing a good biography about Jesus. Paul is saying, I don't want to write a biography. I want to enter into sharing in his suffering. I don't want to just know about Jesus. I want to become like Jesus. Paul is prepared to take on the suffering of Christ. He doesn't want to just know about it. He wants to enter into it. This is someone who wants to know Jesus by walking in the way of Jesus, by knowing him as personally and as closely as he possibly can, to allow the life of Jesus to change the life of Paul. And Philippians becomes the book where Paul describes about as well as anywhere in the Bible what it means to be persistently and passionately, without reservation, in pursuit of Christ. What it means to run the race strong as a disciple of Christ. See, Paul is in prison when he writes to the book in Philippi, and yet the book of Philippians is called the book of joy. Wouldn't it be great to be writing the book of joy while in the prison for having proclaimed the gospel? Philippi is in the northern part of Greece. And because it's in Greece, Paul chooses to dip into the imagery of the Olympics. To pursue Christ is like becoming an Olympic runner. Twice in the three verses, he says, he presses on. He strains toward what is ahead. He's after the goal. He wants to win the prize. It's an all-consuming, all-focused, intent passion to pursue Christ. But Paul also tells us twice that he has not arrived. He's not crossed the finish line. He's not succeeded fully. He's still running. He's still pressing on. The race isn't over. He's still giving it what he can, what he's got. Well, Philippians is no doubt my favorite book in the New Testament. I've been reading and thinking about and studying the book of Philippians since I was in my mid-teens. When I was a kid, I loved sports. Well, I still love sports, but, you know, the ability to play is waning. And in those days, I loved the 100-yard dash. Of course, Paul here is thinking more about a race of endurance. But I still understand the drive, the push, the competitive need to win that kept me running through the pain. But if there's been some things along the years as I've studied this passage that have disturbed me about it, I've never been one to go to the dog races, never done it. But I checked out what a dog race looks like online. These incredible greyhound dogs. And they race around the track at absolutely amazing speeds. And what are they doing? Anybody know? They're chasing a rabbit, but it's mechanical. It's dead on the end of an arm, just going around like that. Is that what Paul is talking about? That I'm pursuing Jesus with everything I got, but he's cagey? He's like the rabbit, never quite getting caught? But it's fun to watch me, the greyhound, bound around the track as fast and as furiously as I can? I spend my whole life chasing someone who's always just one step ahead of me, and it's a competition. Who am I about to beat? Right at the outset, Paul says, I am not perfect. Then in verse 14 again, he says, he's not quite taken hold of it yet. That is, he's not arrived. He hasn't crossed the finish line. He hasn't captured the rabbit, if we will. Well, I can really identify with that. I'm definitely not perfect, and Lori, you cannot describe in the ways I'm not. Just trust me, I am not perfect. I certainly haven't arrived at a high level of spiritual superiority. I bumble along this pathway just like you do. Rarely do I feel like a greyhound running at full tilt after my goal. Most of the time, I don't feel like an Olympic athlete. I feel more like a turtle. doing well just to keep moving. But then remember, it's an endurance race, not a sprint. So what does Paul mean by all of this? Well, what Paul is doing is he's using some very strong physical words, the athletic words. And he's using physical words to help us try and see a spiritual truth, a spiritual path. You know, like, I know that if you run too fast, it won't be long, and you'll be lying by the side of the road completely out of gas. What Paul is trying to get us to see is that the life of pursuing Christ is a life of not running fast, but running single-mindedly. James talks in his book about the pitfalls of being double-minded. You're going in multiple different directions. It means that you have a divided focus. It means that your lives are going in too many different ways. Paul's calling us to have one purpose and one focus and one direction for our life, which is the pursuit of Jesus. And that kind of pursuit is going to require single-mindedness, your full attention. I drive sometimes like a double-minded person. I'm driving, but I'm thinking about something else. You ever done this? Come on, be honest with me now. You're driving with me. We're going down Deerfoot, okay? We're supposed to be going to the new hospital, but you're thinking. And all of a sudden, you see the sign for Okotoks. I've done it. Good thing there's an overpass at Okotoks so you can kind of whip around and come back. I've done it. That's because you're double-minded. You're driving double-minded. You're driving, but your mind is on two different things. You know, what you're thinking about and not where you're supposed to be going. I lost focus. I lost my way. The straining toward is about focus. I see nothing else. I think nothing else but where I'm headed. You see, in the Olympics in their day, they had a post, a nice post, and it stood right at the line where you're supposed to cross, and the runners would fix their eye right on that post and run as hard as they could to complete the run. That's the idea. Jesus is the post is kind of the idea. You're supposed to keep your eyes fixed on him going forward. The straining forward. It's not a distractive life. We press forward toward Jesus, not toward everything else at the same time. Well, I know how it is. I live in the world just like you do. Everything and everybody is screaming at you for your attention. You're supposed to make them and what they care about your first priority. Your boss has his priorities for you. Your wife, your husband has their priorities for you. Your life has it's all piled up. But you know, like I do, that Jesus is to be our first priority. And if he becomes our first priority, then he has this ability to put our other priorities in order. It is Jesus that we pursue first and foremost. In the Old Testament, they call double-mindedness idolatry. And I wonder if maybe we should do the same thing today. An idol is anything that takes something that an idol is anything that replaces Jesus Christ as first place in our life. Idolatry is giving something or someone else that position. Idolatry is allowing the purpose of our life to shift away from Jesus. Idolatry is worrying about something instead of letting Jesus have it. See, what Paul knew in this passage is that you and I carry, we pack a lot of baggage with us. One of my favorite writers is Annie Dillard. She won a Pulitzer back in the 70s for her book, one of her books. And she tells a story in her book, Teaching a Stone to Talk, the story of the Franklin expedition that was going on the Arctic exploration. It's a true story. And the expedition accomplished nothing. All 138 of the officers and men on the ship died in the Arctic. Instead of supplies necessary for their arduous journey, for the brutal 2 or 3 years that they would spend in the Arctic, they loaded the ship with a 1,200-volume library, a hand organ, china place settings, cut glass wine goblets, sterling silver flatware with ornate Victorian design, and the individual officers' initials and family crest engraved on the handles. Years later, when they discovered the remains of the expedition, they found bodies of the men miles from the stranded boat, and they were carrying those sterling silver engraved flatware, books, and pieces of a backgammon board. They drug their past with them to their death. All that baggage ended up being nothing but useless weight. And Paul uses a rare word. In fact, it's so rare here that it's only used this once in the whole Bible. It's a special word. It's the word for forgetting. It's like he put several words together and almost invented a new word here. It's Paul needing a fresh new way to get at something that we all struggle with. We drag our valuables around, never realizing that they're killing us. I remember being at a pastor's conference, only about 40 of us there, all pastors from the same denomination. And one of our pastors was sharing that afternoon, and he was talking, and all of a sudden he reached into his shirt pocket like this, and he pulled out a little folded up old piece of paper, and he read it to us. And it was a letter that he'd received from one of the churches he had served many years earlier. It was one of the most unkind, mean-spirited, and hurtful letters you could ever read. He read it out loud to us. A letter like that should have never been written, should have never been sent, and certainly should have never been given to someone. But at the end of it, I asked this question of myself. What is it still doing in his shirt pocket? He was carrying it across the precarious and dangerous ice of his life, and it was dragging him and holding him back at every turn. All he had to do was reach in there and remember. It was like an old wound that had become his friend, baggage that gave him an excuse for not doing well, something that he could take out of his pocket and shake in the face of God and say, "Look what you did to me." It's all baggage. He felt validated in his bitterness when he could touch that letter. But what good was it doing him? Every decision he was making was looking back at that letter. So much baggage. Paul had to forget the wrong that he had done. He was personally responsible for the murder of many Christians. He had persecuted and tortured the church. The past has a way of wrapping its grip around our necks and choking the life out of our life, and disappointments and broken relationships and failures and betrayals and pain and wounds. It all becomes this heap of baggage, and they're legitimate sufferings. They're legitimate pains. They're legitimate wounds. We're not making them up. They do hurt. They do wound. They cause deep things to happen to us, but they keep us from running. We're stuck. And we feel so justified in our being stuck because we have the letter. Forgetting also has to do with the comparison syndrome. We compare our lives, we compare our failures, we compare our successes, we compare our bodies, we compare our jobs, we compare our families, our income, our houses with other people. We're either proud of what we've got or we're disappointed in what we have, but pride and disappointment become the new package, the baggage that we carry. How can we possibly run with so much baggage on our backs and around our necks and tied to our feet? So what do? Paul says, forget the past. How do you forget the past? Ever try to forget the past? I have. I've learned one lesson. Can't forget it. We don't forget stuff. And when certain little things happen, boom, they come right back, don't they? A little smell. You see the back of somebody that reminds you. You read a book. You see a movie. Oh, there it is again. I thought I'd forgotten that. And there it is. When Jesus says, or when Paul says here, forgetting everything, what he means is cutting the power off, unplugging it, slicing the wire, whatever imagery works for you, no longer allowing it to have any power in your life. See, God says he's able to cast things into the sea of forgetfulness. He actually can forget it. He leaves. We can't quite forget, but we can cut its power. And how do we do that? How do we cut power? Whew. We take hold of Jesus Christ with a single-minded focus. But here's where the passage suddenly pops to life in a whole brand new way. Until this point, it has sounded to me like we have this hard, straining ahead, pressing on, winning, tenacious, pursuing kind of drive, this kind of work to do, that we run like madmen, hoping to outrun all the junk and maybe to someday grab a hold of the rabbit. That we have to hang on to Jesus just like we would hang on to a steel pole sunk in cement in the middle of a great hurricane. And yeah, exactly that. Hang on to Jesus in the middle of the hurricane with a single-minded focus, that our lives are focused on running to him in pursuit of him. But listen to this. We take hold of Jesus Christ, for which Christ took hold of us. We don't just grab a hold of Jesus. He's already grabbed a hold of you. In fact, he started all of this grabbing. When we take a hold of Christ, we discover that he's already taken hold of us. When I thought I was done for in the middle of the storm, Jesus had already taken a hold of me. I thought it was all about me. I had to do all the work. I had to pursue Jesus, who was standing there saying, "Come on, come on, come on, but you'll never get me." I didn't have to get him. He already had me. Oh, yeah, I need to take a hold of Jesus. I know that. No question about it. But how much easier it is to take hold of someone who's already taken a hold of you? How much easier it is to trust someone who already has you, who believes in you, who has a hold on you? How much easier is it to let past go when the one who loves you most is holding on to you? You see, in a strange, and I know what this is like because I'm doing it. In a strange sort of way, we hang on to our past because we find our security in it. It's hard to let go of all that stuff. If we let it go, then who will we be? It's part of our identity. But why do we hang on to all the bad, negative stuff? I mean, that makes no sense. I want it gone. I want it out of here. It's garbage. But if I let go of the betrayal, if I let go of the fact that my closest, dearest friend sold me out, if I let that go, then I'm pretending like it didn't really matter. That betrayal has fueled my passion to never let it happen again. I hold on to that betrayal because if I give it up, then I'll lose part of myself. It's like I'm rolling over. No, not to me. Never again. I like that anger. It makes me feel strong. I got caught in betrayal because I was weak. Never again. And we find ourselves trying to run the race in knee-high mud. Our whole life being defined by our past. Forgetting what is behind, we strain toward Jesus. We run toward the one who has already taken hold of us. We run toward the one whom we can trust. Even in the darkest pain of our past, we run with the one who knows our future. When I was a boy, my mom and dad played a lot of old gospel songs. They played the accordions. That was the early guitar. You know that one. But they played them. And I like the song that they played. Many things about tomorrow I don't seem to understand. But I know who holds tomorrow. And I know who holds my hand. Many things about tomorrow I don't seem to understand. But I know who holds tomorrow. And I know who holds my hand. Now that might just change how we run and if we run. See, we're not just out on a jog going somewhere. We're going somewhere. We're in a race. We have a destiny. And that's running towards the one who has already taken hold of me. Oh, yeah, I know. We've got a lot of pressing and straining and grasping in order to win the prize for which God has called us heavenward. And that prize is this, to know Christ. Not to know about him, not to write another book about him. Nothing wrong with that, but that's not the point. It's to know Christ. And how I want to know Christ. How I want to know the power of his resurrection so that I can run the race that he set out before me. He's the one we pursue single-mindedly. We let go of all of that stuff that has somehow tossed itself onto us and is holding us down. It's got a grasp around our jugular that would hinder us, that would keep us from doing the thing one single-mindedly, which is to pursue Jesus. We release those things today. We release those things today. We no longer grasp it. We grasp him. We no longer place things here. We put him there. We no longer let the past be our future. We allow him to hold our hand. Amen? Let's stand together.